here, and particularly to look around and see many people who've ministered to me over the years and for whose ministries I am very grateful. It's also pleasant to see so many of my contemporaries from university these 20 years ago looking not a day older than they did then. A few weeks ago, I phoned up my erstwhile flatmate from university, Phil Hare, and he said, "Oh, you're speaking at Creef." He said, "That'll be nerve-wracking for you." And I thought he was being very empathic and making a statement about my anxiety about appearing before all of you ministers and men who, as I've said, had spoken to me and ministered to me over the years. But after a pause, he added, "Because that's the meeting they let the women come to." To this title, Kirk Coucher Clinic, Where Should Christians Go for Help? I was seduced by Sandy Tate. My fault, not his. I accept responsibility for succumbing to it into giving you a snappy title. When he spoke to me on the phone, he said, "Sinclair Ferguson always gives us great titles. See if you can come up with a snappy title." And I tried to, and I've come up with something which instantaneously creates a false dichotomy in suggesting that these things are mutually exclusive, which, as I hope by the end of the afternoon, if you're not already persuaded, you will be persuaded that they're not. So I'm not sure whether I'll speak to my own title or answer my own question satisfactorily. What I would like to do, if you will pardon me, is to start with some theoretical stuff and get on to the clinical and pastoral stuff nearer the end. I want to begin by looking at some of the barriers between Christians and psychiatry and psychiatrists, real and imagined, to try and reconcile some aspects of these, to say something to you about contemporary psychiatric practice. Because I have a fantasy, and I don't know if it's correct, that people's thoughts and beliefs about what I do are far removed from the reality of it. And you can tell me at the end whether I'm correct. And then to look at some areas of overlap between my clinical concerns and your pastoral concerns. And I also want to look a little bit at the similarities and differences between the psychiatrist in his or her role and the pastor. I think some of the problems and tensions at the interface between psychiatry and the Christian faith arise from misunderstandings about what these two things are about and what they try to do. Psychiatry in this century has increasingly become a scientific discipline. And I'm going to use a bit of jargon, which I will explain. I hope I'll not use too much jargon this afternoon. But psychiatry in the last 20, 30 years, and psychology, have moved away from what's known as an ideographic approach to seeing things and seeing human beings to what's known as a nomothetic approach. The ideographic approach is perhaps personified in the approach of William James, who was an important psychologist at the end of the last century, and whose psychology was introspective, concerned with unobservable mental experience, which is difficult to study scientifically. Whereas the nomothetic approach, which has come to prevail in psychiatry and psychology, was embodied by James Watson, who felt that psychology should be the science of behavior, that it should use the methods of empiricism, i.e. knowledge through sensory experience, and was very heavily influenced by the work of people like I.P. Pavlov in Russia. I am not clear that there is an inherent conflict between the scientific method espoused by Watson and his successors and Christian belief. And I want to quote something on this from Malcolm Jeeves, Emeritus Professor of Psychology at the University of St. Andrews, who's written a lot about this and written very well. Jeeves says, "The present-day psychologist with behavioristic leanings, who is known merely as a psychologist, might embrace any philosophical or religious viewpoint. This is because behavioristic psychology is for him a methodology, a means of discovering information about behavior, and in no sense a concept of the nature of ultimate reality. For practical purposes, in carrying on his investigations, any scientist must treat what is before him as if it were material, but he has no more notion than anyone else as to what, if anything, lies beyond the range of his senses, even when these are amplified by instruments of science such as microscopes, galvanometers, and electronic devices. As a scientist, he can neither affirm nor deny any particular theory or doctrine of ultimate reality, nor should he be expected to do so any more than a physicist, a chemist, or a physiologist. Objective psychologists, like individuals in other sciences, actually vary a great deal from one to the other with respect to their philosophical or religious beliefs. And I think that's an important fundamental point. I think, a need to appreciate that explanatory models used in psychiatry, or indeed in any other scientific discipline, may differ from Christian models of man, but not necessarily put one immediately into conflict with them, and certainly not necessarily imply that one is somehow true and the other false. An example might help. If someone were to ask a question about what influenced a human being in his or her rate of learning of a particular task, you would get a very different answer depending on whom you asked. If you asked a sociologist, you may get an explanation in terms of social factors. If you asked a behavioral psychologist, you may get an explanation in terms of reinforcement schedules. Someone else might give you a genetic explanation. A psychopharmacologist would certainly give you an explanation in terms of neurotransmitters. And ultimately, in some scientific sense, someone may give you an answer based on knowledge of subatomic physics. Are these explanations mutually exclusive? I don't think they are. There is more than one way of looking at the same event, and different levels of explanation can be complementary. This is what Malcolm Jeeves refers to as nothing buttery. In other words, the view that man is nothing but a complex animal, or nothing but a complex machine, or nothing but the result of a series of environmental forces, or nothing but a collection of atoms. Man is assuredly all of these things, but is equally assuredly nothing but any of these things. Jeeves again, and I quote him, says, "Psychological explanations have provided satisfying answers to many important questions regarding why people think, feel, and act as they do, but it does not pretend to answer life's ultimate questions." An important and fundamental point, I think. There are three major worldviews which have dominated psychiatry and psychology in the 20th century. And I want to say a little bit briefly about each of these three, and maybe a little bit more about one which has come to prevail. These worldviews are the naturalistic worldview, the humanistic worldview, and the transpersonal worldview. And of these, the naturalistic view is the most mainstream. It is, for example, the worldview of behaviorism. It's the worldview of neurophysiology and cognitive psychology. It was espoused by people like James Watson and B.F. Skinner. The humanistic view, espoused by people like Maslow, Carl Rogers, Frankl, and Horney, is essentially a materialistic view of reality. It acknowledges the limitations of science as a basis for knowledge, and because of that, has at times found some favour with Christians. It says, for example, that science ignores qualitative aspects of human experience. However, it diverges from Christian belief in viewing man as inherently good and full of untapped potential. The second major view, the transpersonal, was embodied by Jung, who was the son of a Swiss Reformed pastor, and by William James, who I have already mentioned. This is a view that de-emphasizes the material world. It acknowledges both material and spiritual aspects to life, but de-emphasizes the former. It's interested in the study of so-called expanded consciousness and the use of consciousness-altering techniques, for example, drugs, hypnosis, Eastern religion, the use of the occult. It has hugely influenced the New Age movement in its time, and I think still hugely influences some counselling movements, but certainly does not hugely influence contemporary psychology and psychiatry, though it has done in the past, but that's not the case at present. The most influential contemporary worldview in terms of contemporary psychiatry and psychology is the naturalistic view, which is, of course, itself essentially materialistic, espousing the tools of empiricism and the scientific method. I think it's probably important to emphasize, as Malcolm Jeeves has done in many of his books, to this audience, that only a few behaviorists step across the line of using it as a scientific methodology to the more extreme position of using it as an explanation of everything, of ultimate reality. One such, who will be known to many of you, is B.F. Skinner, who certainly did that in his book Beyond Freedom and Dignity. This brings us into some interesting musings on what is the legitimate territory of psychiatry and psychology, and some people might want to take that up with me later. All I'm going to say just now is that provided psychiatry and psychology stick to what is legitimately their terrain, we as Christians need have no serious concerns about this. I think problems have arisen where psychiatrists and psychologists have stepped across the line, and people like R.D. Lange, for example, and Thomas Saz were very much espousing and selling a worldview rather than a scientific view of how to proceed in psychiatry. But provided we're not in the business of selling a worldview and we stick to what is our medical business, problems, I think, become fewer. I've laboured this a bit, and I think it's because I still encounter an anxiety and a fear about psychiatry amongst some, by no means all, but amongst some Christians. There certainly are anxieties to which we'll return about psychiatry and psychiatrists. My personal experience of a medical student intending to do psychiatry, who was also a Christian and active in the CEU, it showed me a bit of both sides of this. By and large, I was hugely supported by my friends, certainly by my family, by my parents, and certainly by my then minister, James Phillip, who was very encouraging, though he had a peculiarly personal insight into what psychiatrists got up to. But on the other hand, there was certainly a cluster of my Christian friends who viewed this as a bit dodgy, and one or two of them said so. I remember one friend telling me that he thought it would be a waste of my time and I was wasting my medical training to be doing psychiatry. And there were one or two others who took that view. And there still is, I think, even 20 years down the line, a degree of suspicion from some people. I suspect in the pews of your congregations, there will be people who are very, very suspicious of psychiatry and psychiatrists. I was quite struck a couple of years ago when I was asked to give a talk at a UCCF associates group. And the Baptist minister who was chairing the meeting came up to me at the beginning of the meeting and said that he just wanted to warn me. He was very, very supportive. He'd asked me to speak. But he just wanted to warn me that there was a fairly large number of people in the audience who didn't think I should have a job. We certainly didn't think I should have a job as a psychiatrist. And who believed there was no such thing as mental illness and indeed spent some of their spare time going into the local mental hospital exhorting schizophrenics to stop their medication and trying to cast demons out of them. This still occasionally happens. I'm not for any minute suggesting that this is how most Christians behave, but there still is a problem. And there are still Christian people who somehow see psychiatry as inherently anti-Christian. I think they're making the worldview mistake, seeing psychiatry as a rival worldview. Some are suspicious because they see psychiatry as morally liberal, and that probably harks back to the 60s, where there were a number of eccentrics in psychiatry behaving in fairly unusual ways. I would say now my psychiatric colleagues are no more and no less morally liberal than my medical or surgical colleagues. Why are you laughing? The extreme view that there is no such a thing as psychiatric illness, one encounters less. It was certainly in vogue when I was an undergraduate, I think largely due to the influence then in the 70s of Jay Adams, who was the embodiment of Christian anti-psychiatry. And again, if anyone wants to come back at me about that later, that's perhaps something else we can discuss. But I find that less of a problem now. The problem of psychiatry and psychiatrists crossing the line into the territory of others, i.e. you, has been complicated by the fact that you, the clergy, have at some times fallen prey to exactly the same temptation. In the last 30 years, the expansion of the caring professions, both in number and scope, has led to blurring of roles and overlap in the roles of different individuals and different groups, including doctors, psychiatrists, counsellors, clergymen. Some clergymen, I think, sometimes suffering from a crisis of confidence and declining church membership, have fled from the traditional role of the pastor and the preacher and the teacher to the more contemporary role of the counsellor or the therapist. There are many dangers in this, not least these related to lack of training, and these have been cogently pointed out, and you will not be surprised to hear who they've been cogently pointed out by Monty Barker. He points out that the relationship of a pastor to the church members is fundamentally different to that of a doctor or a therapist to a patient, though there may be, often are, shared concerns. The worldview of the pastor is that of Scripture, or at least it should be. The pastor's relationship is not professional nor contractual, but is a personal commitment, a calling from God. And Barker cautions clergy to beware moving from biblical approaches in pastoral caring to medical and secular ones. And I think his caution is justified. Many Christian books on counselling and pastoral care, and certainly written in the 70s and 80s, I think were quite strongly influenced by the self-psychologies, for example. I think I could have gone into almost any Christian bookshop in the land and plucked a book from the shelves and showed you these influences in the writing. And just as an aside, I think the self-psychologies are less compatible with a Christian position than the prevailing cognitive psychology of the 90s is, for example, which tends to stick to scientific method. These psychologies placed emphasis on a sense of self-fulfillment, looking after one's own needs, feeling good, etc., etc., often with little thought for others. Monty Barker contrasts this with a biblical model for pastoral care and quotes John Stott as saying, "The chief function of the pastor is teaching and to feed and pastor his sheep." Commenting on this, Barker said, "It is not primarily the model of a healer, facilitator or counsellor, nor the finder of appropriate texts for problems, but rather that of a nourisher and feeder who provides food and makes sure it is appropriate and received." That's your job. This is not the main job of the psychiatrist, though the wise psychiatrist will neither ignore nor undermine the spiritual dimensions in their patients. We've recently been fortunate in the Royal College of Psychiatrists to have a Christian president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. Andrew Sims, Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Leeds, was for 4 or 5 years the President of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, and used his time in office to try and raise amongst psychiatrists awareness of the importance of the spiritual dimension of their parents' experience. Sims wrote wisely, and he wrote this in a medical journal, "Psychiatrists who ignore the spiritual dimension of their patients are in danger of imposing an entirely secular view of the world upon the patient. This is bad psychiatry, because it denies the patient's own phenomenological perspective. The psychiatrist also puts himself in a position of spurious omnipotence, giving the impression that his most dependent patients rely solely on him for their motivation and continuing stability." The principal role of the psychiatrist is in the diagnosis and treatment of mental illness. Psychiatrists are doctors. They have had a medical training. Their training is essentially based on the scientific method. Psychiatrists in training study neuroanatomy, neurophysiology, psychopharmacology, genetics, neurology. They also study psychology and sociology. Psychiatrists' strengths lie in treating the major mental illnesses. For all, these are far from being conquered. But our strengths lie in dealing with people with the major mental illnesses, things like schizophrenia, bipolar illness, which may be better known to you as manic depressive illness, depression, eating disorders, dementia, etc. And just as an aside, you may be interested to hear this, I would expect that in the next 10 to 15 years, there will be significant advances in the treatment of dementia, at least arresting its advancement. That I can see coming. And that will have a lot of implications for society and indeed for yourselves. But this is... well... and maybe myself. Well, it will. We'll come back to that later. Yeah. But this is the business of psychiatry. Psychiatrists are less good and less trained at dealing with things like anger, bitterness, despair, envy, etc., etc., etc. In some respects, I'm creating a false dichotomy again, as these emotional states can be features of mental disorder. But most folk with these emotional problems do not suffer from mental disorder. The reverse is not true. And I think it's at least debatable for people with problems in these areas whether psychiatrists are the most appropriate people to be dealing with them. And one of the reasons I mention this is that Christians requesting to see Christian psychiatrists often fall into that category rather than into the category of people with actual psychiatric disorder. And I'm going to come back to that. One thing I thought that it would be useful to do would be to update you on how the average psychiatrist, adult psychiatrist in the NHS works today. And this is me back to my fantasy on the difference between what I do and what I think you think I do. And here I admit readily to a degree of defensiveness. Referrals to psychiatrists in the NHS have risen steadily, almost everywhere, in the last 10 to 15 years. I'm not going to go into the reasons for that, but I will later if you want me to. The numbers of psychiatrists in post has risen only slightly, and indeed at present there are serious problems in recruiting psychiatrists right across the UK. There are 48 unfilled consultant psychiatrist posts in Scotland, which is a bit over 10% of the number of psychiatrists there should be. This increasing workload has inevitably had an effect on the way that psychiatrists have to work. And if I contrast my undergraduate experience of psychiatry, where generally psychiatrists had plenty of time to talk to people, to listen to what they had to say, with what happens now, the difference is just huge. And I don't want this to degenerate into a sob story, because it's not that, but I think it probably is important you have some understanding of the realities of the NHS. My current caseload is around 250, plus what I supervise from my junior doctors. Last week I saw between 50 and 60 outpatients, and I had my inpatients to see. And the reason I'm spelling this out is that the average consultant adult psychiatrist simply doesn't have time to sit listening to people for hours every week. Most patients will see the psychiatrist once a month, maybe less often, and often not at great length. And this is partly because the way the NHS is organised, it's the doctors who have to provide the emergency reactive service. So we have to respond very quickly to requests to see people. And the in-depth psychological work is often left to our colleagues working in psychology or occupational therapy, or even some of the nurses who can cap their caseloads because they don't have to provide a reactive kind of service. So the likelihood is if you're having a psychological treatment in the NHS these days, you will not be having it from a consultant psychiatrist because he or she simply will not have the time to do that unless they're a dedicated psychotherapist who doesn't have to take any of the general work. And as I say, I'm telling you this not as a sob story, but to do a bit of reality testing with you. I think this leads us nicely into a discussion of some of the hopefully relevant clinical and pastoral issues. There aren't many scientific studies of mental illness in Christians or indeed in people with any strong religious belief. But it seems to me and to my fellow Christian psychiatrists that there's little reason to suppose that Christians should be protected from mental illness, nor are they. We must go through many hardships to enter the kingdom of God, said Paul and Barnabas to the church at Antioch. And for some of us, that will include experience of mental illness. And I think we can't expect any less. The experience of some of the great men of Scripture, Elijah, Job, David, Paul himself, and indeed the subsequent experience of countless Christians over the generations, people like Martin Luther and William Cowper, both of the latter certainly had florid psychiatric illness, had a bipolar affective disorder. And I think there's good evidence that Luther had recurrent depressions. But the experience of men like these provides us with ample evidence, if we need it, that walking with God does not confer immunity from mental disorder and even from florid mental illness. In this regard, William Cowper's life is well worthy of study, and I would commend the study of his life to anyone who's interested in this area. He, as I said, suffered from a severe bipolar affective disorder or manic depressive psychosis. His life was punctuated with episodes of severe mental illness requiring hospitalization. He had profound depressions in which he became completely detached from reality, and that greatly affected his spiritual life. He became convinced that God didn't love him. He became convinced he had committed the unforgivable sin. He became convinced he had been damned to hell. And in some of the phases of his depressive illness, these were clearly delusions. He held these beliefs with delusional intensity. He also seems to have engaged in suicide attempts. So interestingly, and this is another one for discussion, some of his biographers appear to have tried to sanitize that, but I'm in no doubt that he made some suicide attempts. And he oscillated into episodes of mania, where he was over-talkative, disinhibited, up all night, very, very difficult to handle. Through all of this, and in a pre-medication era, Cowper managed to serve God faithfully and to give us some wonderful hymns. And just as an aside here, the role of John Newton in Cowper's life, I think, provides you with some model of what a pastor and a friend can be. Newton was a son of encouragement to Cowper in every sense of the word. One of the reasons I labour that is that some unsympathetic biographers, some of whom should know better, have attributed Cowper's mental disorder to his evangelical leanings and to the adverse influence of Newton. Anyone who knows anything about this will know that that's far from the truth. Newton took this man into his own home to live with him when he was at his worst, when he was manic as well as when he was depressed. Now, I find it hard sometimes to be in a room for an hour with a manic person. They're incredibly demanding. And yet, Newton took his friend into his own home and ministered to him and helped him get through the slough of despond. This notwithstanding, there isn't evidence that Christians are particularly prone to mental illness, though I think we should add two riders to that comment. The first is, there is evidence that churches attract higher proportions of people with neurosis and personality disorder than do other social groupings. And commenting on this, both Andrew Sims, writing as a psychiatrist, and Professor Donald MacLeod have remarked that far from being a cause for concern, this is something that we should praise God for and give him thanks for. And indeed, were the reverse the case, we should be concerned. It would be a sorry and a sad thing for the church if the anxious, the odd, the eccentric, the despised and rejected of society did not find a welcome amongst God's people. And the good news is it appears in general that they do, because they're certainly represented in higher numbers in our midst, and scientific researchers looking at this have got no doubt that it's to do with what they call social drift. In other words, it's not the church that's making people neurotic and personality disordered. You'll be relieved to hear. It's just that they go there because they find a welcome there. And for the most part, they're not rejected. The second rider, and this is a bit of a personal note, is that there is some evidence that in some Christian denominations, there are higher rates of psychosomatic illness. This is something that interests me because that's my particular area of interest within psychiatry. And I have my own views about how and why that happens. But personally, my view is that Christians have average rates for mental disorder, though certainly in scientific terms that merits further study. But what does that mean to you? Well, it means this, that in your congregations you will have large numbers of people with mental disorders. And if you haven't, you just don't know about it, or you're not looking hard enough. Because about 3-5% of the population in 1 year will meet diagnostic criteria for major depressive illness. The lifetime risk for schizophrenia is 1%. The lifetime risk for bipolar affective disorder is 1%. Phobias are very common. I'm going to drift into an aside here because phobias are very common. And one of the reasons you might be interested to hear this is that phobias, and agoraphobia in particular, when it comes with panic attacks, is something that stops people coming to church. And you will probably have people in your churches who don't come because of that. A couple of weeks ago, I went to a discussion with some fellow elders in my own church. We got together to discuss pastoral problems in our districts. And one of my colleagues unsympathetically said, "There's a lady in my district who never comes to church. She says she's agoraphobic, but I think she just needs a kick up the backside." Now, I happen to know he was being decidedly unsympathetic and wrong. But there are ways you can help these people come to church, and I will digress and tell you how. If you're in the Brock White seat there and you've got agoraphobia and panic attacks, you will be terrified. You're in this crowded place, it's warm, you can't get out, you're sweating, your heart's beating fast, you're thinking, "I'm going to have a heart attack," or "I'm going to die," and you cannot get out. So you stop coming because it's such an unpleasant experience. The agoraphobic seat is the William Phillips seat up the back there.
This is a
claustrophobic
seat.
Yes. No, I mean agoraphobia.
Both of them,
yeah. Oh. Agoraphobics don't like crowds. People, I've got Christians with panic disorder, and what I say to them is, well, take someone else to church with you. Get someone to take you. Ask them to send someone to take you. And sit at the back, or sit near a door, and okay it with the minister that you can go out if things get appallingly bad, because you're near the door, you can nip out. So there are ways around that. That's a digression, but it's just a little tip, if you like. So all of you will have contact with a number of people who have a psychiatric disorder. Some of you will have had such disorders yourselves. Others of you, I should say others of us, will in the future have such disorders. We will have people in our families who have such disorders because psychiatric disorder is common. One of the most vexed questions in this area for Christians and for ministers is there still is this reluctance amongst Christians to see a psychiatrist. This is not unique to Christians. Psychiatry, to some extent, remains stigmatized within society. You only need to open a newspaper or watch a television program to see this. Arguably, a little more stigmatized within the churches, or at least some churches, and I think some denominations are worse than others in this regard, though in my albeit biased view is that the Reformed churches do rather better in this regard than some others do. The reluctance stems from many sources, some of which I've already mentioned, including the mistake of equating psychiatry with psychoanalysis, which it certainly isn't to be equated with all its overtones of Freud and his antipathy to religion. There are still some who adhere to the Adams anti-psychiatry view, though, as I said earlier, I think they're increasingly few. But perhaps most commonly, Christians worry that the psychiatrist himself or herself will be unsympathetic to their beliefs and values. And such people often insist, or try to insist, on seeing a Christian psychiatrist. This is a big issue, not least for we who are Christian psychiatrists. I think there are some things that can usefully be said. The issue is easiest to deal with when one considers those with more severe psychiatric illness, people with schizophrenia, with bipolar affective disorder, with recurrent major depression. If my wife or one of my sons or my daughter was to develop such a disorder, my first concern would be to find a psychiatrist who was knowledgeable and competent in these areas and good with these kind of patients. To have a Christian would be a bonus. The mainstay of these major psychiatric disorders is medical and pharmacological. That's not to say that's all that can or should be done with these patients, but nonetheless, that is of the essence in these disorders. And the overriding concern should be with finding a good doctor. Things become less clear when you move to what I call the fringes or the blurred boundaries of psychiatry. For example, when you do move into the realm of personality disorder, or of dealing with the ghosts from the past type of problem, or in dealing with sexual problems or marital problems. When we get into that realm, the psychiatrist's beliefs may become of more importance. Though even in this area, I don't think Christians should decry the contribution that a skilled psychotherapist can make, because by doing so, they sometimes rob themselves of valuable help. A few weeks ago, a man turned up on my doorstep late one Sunday night, having been given my name and address by a Christian psychiatrist colleague down south. And he came to speak to me about his daughter, who was an adopted daughter, and who prior to the adoption had been sexually abused and treated in all manner of horrific ways. And he wanted me to guide him to a Christian child and adolescent psychiatrist. And I asked him to give mainstream NHS care a go. And he gave it a go for about 2 days and phoned back and still said he wanted a Christian psychiatrist. And I think he's going to get to see a Christian psychiatrist. But at the end of the day, with this girl's particular problems, I think he could have done very well staying with the mainstream, because there was someone around very skilled in working with these people who I think could have helped them. And you have to consider the skills and interests and abilities of the psychiatrist as much as his or her Christian faith at times. For example, I know a very eminent psychiatrist who's a Christian, who's done scientific research on Alzheimer's disease at the pushing back the boundaries of science level. A very eminent man. I suspect he would not be terribly much use in counselling someone who'd been sexually abused. And the fact that he's a Christian doesn't alter that. And I think it does need to be said, though, perhaps more to your flocks than to yourselves, that all problems are not solved. and finding a Christian psychiatrist is no panacea. All problems are not solved. God in his wisdom allows us to carry some problems, including personality difficulties, throughout our lives. Though people can change and be healed, of course I believe that, but there are thorns in the flesh which are not removed. There are some situations, and I concede this, in which Christian psychiatrists have the advantage over non-Christian colleagues in dealing with other Christians. For example, we can be helpful in teasing out spiritual causes and consequences of disorder, and in helping to distinguish spiritual problems from psychiatric ones. I want to interject another aside here, because there are sometimes wrong reasons for Christians requesting to see Christian psychiatrists. And the two main wrong reasons that I have encountered are that some Christians want a psychiatrist with whom they feel they can cross the professional boundary. And if they find a Christian, they can do that. And they think that they'll have more rights than the average patient because of your shared faith. And some, I have to say, this happens only in a minority of cases, but it does happen. And sometimes they feel they'll be able to manipulate or even emotionally blackmail the therapist more successfully if they share their faith. The second wrong reason why some Christians want to see a Christian psychiatrist is that they're sometimes not really wanting someone to help them as much as someone to collude with them in their efforts to spiritualize away what the real problem is, rather than face it. One of the starkest examples I've seen of this was in a clergyman of another denomination who I treated many years ago, along with his wife, and who was literally never at home, spent almost no time with his wife or his children, and always spiritualized it away. It was okay for him to do this and to behave like this, sometimes in a grossly insensitive way, because he was doing God's work. And he was staggered when I failed to collude with his view of what the problem was. In a sense, he was hoisting his own petard for insisting on a Christian psychiatrist. So I can see by the nods and the grunts that you're all aware that spiritualization can, for Christians, be a defense mechanism, a means of blocking off, shutting out, or avoiding sensible discussion of problems and their solutions. To summarize on this point then, in terms of whether or not a person should see a Christian psychiatrist, I think each case probably has to be seen on its own merits. And Christians should avoid neglecting the need for professional skills in their therapists, seeing Christian faith as the only important attribute of a psychiatrist. I want to change tack a bit, again, just to go back and pick up on something we kind of bypass. One thing that has struck me over the years is the difference in the case mix of patients referred to me by GPs and patients referred directly or indirectly through ministers. The ministers may say, go to the GP and see this Christian psychiatrist. The latter group, the group that you refer, are undoubtedly less psychiatrically ill than the former group, but are undoubtedly hugely more complicated. It's unusual for someone with schizophrenia or manic depression or anything like that to reach me through a minister. And in fact, the people who come through ministers are often coming with the kind of ghosts from the past problem that I referred to earlier on, with difficulties in interpersonal relationships, problems of temperament, sexual problems, things like that. And as I've already pointed out to you, the psychiatric illness problems for me are far easier to deal with, because that's principally what I'm trained to deal with, than these other problems. And that sometimes leads to disappointment from, you know, I think probably for all parties. But these psychiatric illness problems are easier to deal with. One of the most sensible things written in the kind of ghosts from the past and problems related to upbringing and temperament that I've seen is Ray Melia's wee book, Free from the Past. I don't know if this book is still in print, I think it came out about 8 or 9 years ago, but it's an excellent book, and I would commend it to you. And I frequently recommend it to Christian patients with these kinds of problems. Some of these people, though again, I'm not saying the majority, have expected that when they become Christians, these problems would kind of instantaneously evaporate and be dealt with. And they're often devastated to find out that that isn't the case. This is one area in which your preaching can have an enormous impact and be of enormous import. Packer, in Knowing God, I think it was, cautioned against that cruel kind of preaching which promises people the moon if only they'll become Christians. Texts plucked from Scripture, often out of context, promising a life free of pain or indeed painful emotions. I have to say I've been fortunate in that I personally have rarely heard any minister preach such a gospel, but such evangelists must exist because some of my patients still seem to hear them. Needless to say, such unbiblical error can lead to or perpetuate colossal psychological problems, including futile attempts to deny the reality of pain or the need to grieve or the presence of unpleasant feelings, be they angry feelings, feelings of envy, sexual feelings. In this view of things, biblical joy is often reduced to an incessant flow of superficial happiness and laughter. But it isn't. Indeed, we are told in the Scripture that it can exist in the midst of tears. And it comes from the confidence that although things seem and indeed can be awful, our lives have a solid foundation in the love and in the power of Christ. And of course, the other side of that superficial view of what constitutes joy is that that kind of bubbly, superficial, always smiling joy can be grossly insensitive and can affect relationships in the family of God. To deny the reality of these painful emotions is folly. And I think in your preaching and in your pastoral care, you have a duty to teach people this and to help them to see that this is part of normal Christian experience. You can deliver a dose of preventative medicine in this regard. And I think the other thing that you can help people understand is that sanctification doesn't occur in a tabula rasa. That we can't deny the importance of our past, not that we need to be prisoners to it, but we can't deny that it exists and that it's important. Ray Melia quotes J.C. Ryle, I think, in her book in this regard. And he wrote, "Thus, the defect lies here. Sanctification is rather expected than worked for, rather anticipated as the necessary growth of the germ implanted in regeneration, than a development dependent on positive cultivation on the part of man and on positive energies distinctly and designedly put forth on the part of the great efficient agent, the Holy Ghost. In justification, our works have no place at all, and simple faith in Christ is the one thing needful. In sanctification, our own works are of vast importance, and God bids us fight and watch and pray and strive and take pains and labour. Sanctification is eminently a progressive work and admits of continual growth and enlargement so long as man lives." I'm going to close in a few minutes, but I want to wind up by running through briefly and fairly superficially some things that I think you can do to help people with mental illness and with psychological difficulties in your congregations. Firstly, I think it's important that you legitimise their experience, that you acknowledge the reality of their distress, whether it amounts to frank psychiatric illness or some kind of emotional problem. Secondly, I think it's important for all of us to remember the differences of temperament which by nature people have been given. And we have to remember that in our dealings with people. I remember when I was an undergraduate, James Phillip mentioned this in a sermon at Holyrood, and it hit me between the eyes, and I have remembered it ever since. And there's not a day goes by in my working life when I don't remember it. And it's that people are not all the same. And the crotchety old man in Graham's hospital ward this morning, what did happen to him to make him like that? What was his experience like? What was he born like? Some of us are born gurning. Some of us, we're born with different temperaments. Some of us have to summon up huge efforts of will to be polite to people and not to be irritable. Whereas others are born with sunny temperaments by nature. And we can sometimes blur the boundaries and mistake spiritual advancement for things that are purely there by nature. They were the way you were wired at birth. That's not an excuse for the irritability and the bad temper, but just recognising that people are not all made the same. Thirdly, I think it's important to encourage self-help and not to create invalids. And this has to be done with enormous tact, because the boundary between being insensitive and, as my elder friend would have it, giving somebody a kick in the backside, and allowing people to remain as invalids can sometimes be a difficult one to negotiate. And we need to be sensitive, but we need to make sure that our behaviours are not perpetuating invalidism in people, that we're trying to help them move on. Next, I think we probably too often prescribe rest and relaxation. There are people who are counselled to death. You know, just stay up with me for another few hours while I counsel you. When what they need is a good night's sleep, or to be sent away for a holiday. 10 weeks in Africa would be nice. I don't begrudge them one second of it. But I think that's an important point. You have to use your common sense with people sometimes rather than any subtle wisdom. When people need medical help, I think we should encourage and support the decision to seek it when necessary. That always raises the question of when people do need medical help. And all I would say to you is, if in doubt, err on the safe side. I.e., it's best to encourage too many than too few to go and see their doctors. It is important to provide a listening ear. That goes without saying. It is important not to promise a quick fix, because often there are no quick fixes. Often there are no slow fixes in some senses. You know better than me that many people who come to you need acceptance and forgiveness. And the main reason that I mention this is that I think it's desperately important for me and for you that we're seen as the kind of people who foster this, because there are still some people who won't come near us because they fear censoriousness and harshness. I think it's important to use well those in your church who are gifted in working with these kind of people, to look for the Barnabases, to look for the sons and the daughters of encouragement. Some people are great at getting alongside people in distress and can be the source of much solace and healing and encouragement for them. For example, as Newton was with Cowper. And the last thing I want to leave you with is this notion of helping people to remember, which I think is your job. And this is something Os Guinness wrote at length about in his book Doubt. The need to remind people without the kind of text-plucking, text-prescribing approach to things that I mentioned earlier, to help people to remember how God has dealt with them in the past, to help people to remember God's faithfulness, his deliverance, his unchangingness, his salvation. You and I sometimes, often, not sometimes, often, have difficulties in remembering that. When people are mentally ill, and particularly when they're depressed, they have huge difficulties in remembering that. Read what Cowper wrote in his journal and in his memoirs about how he felt about God when he was depressed. People need reminded. And I will close with Horatius Bonar's words from one of his hymns, which is one of my favourites. I change, he changes not. His love will never die. His peace, not mine, the resting place. His truth, not mine, the tie.
John.
God, and tell us a little more and define more. What is schizophrenia?
That's a good question. Schizophrenia. schizophrenia is probably the severest, the most severe of the mental disorders. I think it's a brain disease, and I think it is important to say that, although social and environmental factors contribute to it, these people are fundamentally suffering from a brain disease. It's a psychosis, by which I mean the ability to draw accurately the boundaries between reality and unreality are lost. People's experience of what's real and what's unreal becomes blurred or lost altogether. So, and the core kind of clinical features of people with schizophrenia when they're very ill are things like hallucinations and delusions. In other words, they hear voices, usually talking about them, often criticising them, often saying they're bad or telling them to do things that are bad. They develop persecutory ideas. They feel people are watching them, that people are trying to hurt them or harm them. They may feel their phones have been tapped, that cameras are hidden in their houses to watch them. These are what are called the positive symptoms. And they're relatively easy to treat. What's devastating in schizophrenia, however, is not so much these symptoms, but the kind of insidious personality change that happens in sufferers. They often become withdrawn. Their thinking becomes muddled. They can't speak coherently. They sometimes speak very, very little or not at all. Worse, they can become mute. They stop looking after themselves. They take little interest in their surroundings. They take little interest in any kind of social interaction often. And that can be far more devastating, partly because it's far more difficult to treat than these kind of florid, colourful symptoms that they get. Yes, very often. Yes, they often develop beliefs that they are being persecuted.
And can it be treated?
Yes, but it has to be said, it can be treated, and some people get good results from treatment. Treatment stops some people getting worse or stops them relapsing so often. But there are some people, probably about 20% of people with schizophrenia, who don't respond at all to treatment. And even of the rest, most of them have to live with it to varying degrees for the rest of their lives.
That's a very good question, John. Thank you very much. Now, sir.
Sir, I have a sister who's a psychiatric nurse. And one question that she's asked me, she's not a Christian, but she's asked me, why do folks with schizophrenia, with their delusions, why are many of them of a religious nature? Could you answer that?
Yeah. Well, psychiatrists, and particularly, there's a Christian psychiatrist group, and we, this is something we often talk about. We distinguish between the form that a patient's symptoms take and the content of these symptoms. The form would mean that they're having hallucinations or delusions. They're hearing things or seeing things, or they're imagining things that aren't true. The content would be what the hallucinations or the delusions are about. And as you rightly say, hallucinations and delusions to do with Christianity are quite common, though in fact there's some evidence they're less common than they used to be. If you read Cowper's accounts of his own mental illness, nearly all his psychotic material was religious in content. And I suppose my simple answer to that is that it very often reflects people's personal experience or the experience of the culture they're in. You don't get very many people with schizophrenia imagining that they're Christ or the Virgin Mary in non-Christian countries. So the actual content of symptoms is more to do with culture than anything about the illness per se. It's to do with the person's personal experience. I had a girl last year who, within weeks of becoming a Christian, developed a manic episode and was grossly elevated in her mood and believed she was the Virgin Mary. And she's fortunately very well now and back to work and has done superbly, but that was merely a reflection of her particularly recent experience, which was a very genuine conversion experience.
Mike.
Yeah. Tom, it was interesting what you were saying about advances in the treatment of dementia. We have a woman in our congregation who's recently been diagnosed as having Huntington's chorea. Mm. Are there any similar advances with that?
No, but that's a very good question. Huntington's chorea is a... Does everybody know what Huntington's chorea is?
No.
It is an awful form of dementia. And it is awful because it is strongly heritable. And it doesn't manifest itself usually until the 40s or 50s, by which time the sufferers have usually married and usually have children. One in two of their children suffer from the illness. Huntington's, and it's just awful. They dement and they develop movement disorders. They can't swallow, they writhe around, they can't walk properly. It's a very, very unpleasant kind. No dementia is pleasant, but Huntington's is particularly awful because of the earliest age of onset and the high certainty that half your children will have it. The reason your question is particularly germane, Mike, is that Huntington's illustrates what's probably going to happen in some other areas of psychiatry. The gene for Huntington's chorea was discovered in the 80s. And very recently, the product of that gene has been elucidated. In other words, we now know exactly what the gene does. The discovery of the gene allows you to genetically counsel people. You can tell people whether or not they're at risk. Though that raises all sorts of interesting ethical dilemmas, and some people choose not to know. I suppose the problem for the doctors is if they choose not to know and they then go and have four children, half of these children are going to suffer from the illness. But the gene product has now been elucidated. We know exactly what the gene does. And when you get to that kind of level, treatments begin to be more likely. So there is no treatment just now, but it may not be many miles away. The dementia I was alluding to, that there will be treatment for, I think, in the next 10 to 15 years, is Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Bear in mind that you mentioned that any recommendations or referrals we might make to a psychiatrist on acute mental illness might be very limited. And you also stress the fact of self-help. Could we, as ministers, should we be comfortable with recommending popular psychology such as Scott Peck or Susan Jeffers or something like that?
I think you get onto much dodgier ground there. Scott Peck is very New Agey, I think, for example. And a lot the popular psychologies, the kind of counselling on the street corner, as opposed to in the NHS, are the popular psychologies are without a doubt more heavily influenced by the humanistic and transpersonal psychologies, which I think are probably inherently more difficult to reconcile with the Christian position, if only because they, rather more than the behaviourists, step over the line, if you like, and peddle a worldview. Unfortunately, the behaviourists that everyone know about are people like Watson and Skinner, who did step over the line, but they're in a tiny minority.
Can I ask, is it really generally safe to refer people to the NHS? I must confess that I've got someone in the congregation just now who really is going through some counselling, and I'm a wee bit worried that they're getting some of this dodgy stuff you're telling me about.
All I can say is that it is much less likely on the NHS than it is in the private sector. It's not impossible, but it's much less likely in the NHS than it is in the private sector or the voluntary sector.
Can I ask for how long will the NHS become contaminated, if you like, by this form?
No. If anything, it will go the opposite way, funnily enough. I mean, I hope it does become more Christian, but that's not what I meant by the opposite way. If anything, psychotherapy and counselling will be more marginalised than the NHS, not less, because of resource constraints. The Scottish Office has just produced a document basically exhorting us to spend our time treating people with manic depression, schizophrenia and major depression, and to forget the rest. I mean, I paraphrase.
I just want to ask if you're more likely to get dodgy stuff from Christian counsellors than from the NHS.
Well, that's a good question, William. I think Christian counsellors are by no means immune from it. And in fact, one of the problems with Christian counsellors, some of the highest quality counselling that I've come across in the voluntary sector is actually from the Church of Scotland, because they at least insist on fairly high levels of training. But a lot of Christian counsellors have had barely no training at all. And people have got all sorts of, you know, bizarre notions of what you might do. You know, opening up old hurts, for example, releasing the kind of psychic pus. You know, people think that's a great idea and inevitably results in folk getting better. It doesn't. It sometimes results in people getting worse. And, you know, trying to get it all out is not always the smart thing to do. And that's a trap that Christian counsellors sometimes fall into.
Does anybody know what a Christian counsellor is? What is this category of person?
I think that's an unanswerable question, because they are as variable as counsellors
else. They're putting up a brass plate outside saying...
Very few. There are some. There are some places. Yeah.
The reason I ask that is that I must have had in the last 6 months half a dozen things that have come through as leaflets in various Christian magazines offering a weekend course on this, that, or the other type of Christian counselling.
Yes.
My impression is that there are lots of people in churches who think that this is a great thing to get people mobilised and counselling within their churches, and they're sending them off to one of these things. Yeah. Coming back, and we are the counsellors in the fellowship. I just worry a great deal of what kind of thing is going on there.
I think you're probably right to be worried. I think it's probably more prevalent in England than in Scotland, but then some of these things do come along a few years later. And you're quite right that these things do fall out of Christian magazines or stand out from the adverts. And I think they're as variable in quality and training as Christians and as counselling in the kind of general sector. I think I tried to warn against over-counselling people and the kind of cult for counselling. The Scottish Office has, in fact, been working on a kind of evaluation of counselling, and it's not going to come out terribly sympathetic.
Come on, then. Wait a minute. Just a pause.
I just wanted to say that a couple of years ago, one of our members lost his mother and was not coping very well with the grief at all. For a long time, and I felt that this was far more than we in the church could provide support for, and I encouraged him to seek professional help from the NHS. This took some months before anything happened at all, and it seemed that it was going to take months and months before anything continued to happen. Eventually he received counselling through CRUSE, which in fact was very effective, and he is now in fact a bereavement counsellor himself and is providing a lot of support in that area. But we felt in the church that we were having to provide a form of support for this man for a long while before the NHS could actually get round to pick him up.
That will get worse. That will not get better. He probably had to wait months because he was referred to a psychologist. Psychologists cap their caseloads so they can spend... We can work with patients fairly intensively. The average waiting list is about 6 months. Someone like that would not be prioritised by the psychiatric system because he would be way behind others in the queue. And we often would be sending people like that to CRUSE as well.
What's CRUSE? Right?
CRUSE is a voluntary sector organisation which provides bereavement counselling.
Meaning?
Widow's Cruise, yes.
Is that a C for Christian?
No. It's a biblical allusion.
Oh. Rams the shield. Speak up, Rams.
I want to make a comment. I would feel that I was overstepping the mark if I had to say to someone, well, maybe you should be speaking to a psychiatrist, Christian or otherwise. Two cases I have recently, I suggested to the person to speak to their GP, full stop, and he or she is the person who is medically trained recognize the symptoms perhaps of not eating or not sleeping or talking about harming themselves, but recommend in the first instance please speak to your GP. Yes. There was someone in that situation who had a mild course of antidepressants prescribed, and at the end of that, they're close to it. But my feeling would be any reference should be to the first port of the call medically.
I would not disagree with that. Yeah, thank you for making that point.
I would imagine some people have more of a predisposition towards mental illness, certain forms of mental illness, than other people. Are there ways in which people can lead a particular kind of lifestyle which is preventative, at least to some extent?
The science. Well, the scientific answer to that question, Donald, is no. There's not good evidence about strategies for preventing mental disorder. And that's sad, but it's true. I mean, I think, so one resorts anecdotally to kind of common sense advice, you know, about looking after yourself, making sure you get enough rest, making sure you pace yourself, making sure you don't work round the clock 7 days a week, having confidants that you can speak to and unburden to, you know, cultivating friendships, cultivating a variety of interests. You know, you need some interests outside, in your case, the ministry. But the scientific answer to your question is there are no rigorous studies showing that these things are preventable, save by things like genetic counselling, when that only applies to some of the disorders, obviously, because they're varyingly inheritable.
Klaus Bure, this is the man you wanted to see. Look at him.
I think I heard you suggest earlier on that the church contributes to psychosomatic illness. I've been there to expand on that.
I did. Yeah. I think it goes with Christian anti-psychiatry, the link with psychosomatic illness, and the notion that mental disorder doesn't or can't exist for the Christian. And if you're from a denomination, for example, that's less friendly to psychiatry and is antipathetic to it, it's quite difficult for you to present with mental disorder, saying you're depressed and you need to see a doctor, because there are clearly, and this is not a particular Church of Scotland problem, but there are clearly some churches who would discourage that. And so these patients present with sore tummies and headaches and aches and pains and this, that and the other. Now that's something that a few of us Christians have talked about and think happens. But at the minute, it's our opinion. It's not. I'm not selling that as fact, but I believe it to be the case.
Sure.
Well, I'm interested to know a little more about the agoraphobics chair. I find that very interesting, the comment you were making about other members of the Kirk session talking about that. I wonder if you'd expand on that and also tell us what the result was in that particular case, please.
Well, agoraphobia with panic attacks is a particularly common disorder. And although agoraphobia, and you alluded to this with your remark, although agoraphobia literally means fear of the marketplace, people with agoraphobia get terrified in crowds. They're the kind
What's
of
the one that's when you're afraid of open spaces? What disease?
It's the same thing.
Oh.
Yeah. I'm just updating you.
Ah.
They get fear of closed spaces as well and crowds, and they don't like shops, they don't like going to Tesco's, they don't like going to football matches, anywhere that's busy and that's difficult to get. Lots of you are saying you've got it. Yes. See me afterwards. And they often panic in these situations, and when they panic, they feel they're going to have a heart attack or a stroke or something catastrophic is going to happen, and they often fear being embarrassed and humiliated in public. And a church for these people is such a place. At least a busy church is. and one way of helping these people is to say to them, well, look, if you have to get up and go out, that's fine. Sit near the door or sit at the back, because they will invariably feel much, much safer if they've got an exit route, if they've got an escape. You can get a friend to sit with them or to bring them. I'm not saying to collude with their non-attendance at church, but to be imaginative and facilitative in getting them back. And in fact, that's good psychiatric treatment as well, because the last thing you do if you've got a phobia of any sort is to continue to avoid exposing yourself to it. So coming to church is good for them spiritually, and it's good for them psychologically.
James Stewart.
I wonder if you could maybe comment on some of the reports that we've heard recently about the link between mental illness and drug taking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of us, well, most of us will have some dealing with that, really. Just any comments to make?
It's a huge link, and it's a huge problem. The link is mostly between drug taking and severe psychiatric illnesses, like psychotic illnesses, paranoid psychoses, schizophrenia, etc., etc. It's a slightly complex problem, and it's complex because of this. Some drugs, like amphetamine sulfate, for example, can in and of themselves cause psychosis. Cocaine can cause psychosis. But, and this is where it gets complicated, and for these patients, the best treatment is to get them away from the drug, obviously. But it gets complicated because lots of people with psychotic illnesses, like schizophrenia and mania, also misuse these drugs. And it obviously makes the disorder worse rather than better. They invariably comply very, very poorly with medical treatment, and their behaviour can be quite frightening and have serious consequences of them misusing drugs in addition to being psychotic. And there's quite a large area of overlap. There's some evidence that psychiatrists tend to over-diagnose drug-induced psychotic states because they're reluctant to make a diagnosis of schizophrenia because of, you know, the appalling implications of that. And just as an aside, psychiatrists often vacillate about diagnosis, and you shouldn't read too much into that. It's just that some of these things take time to diagnose, and you don't want to prematurely tell someone that their 16-year-old son's got schizophrenia if it's something else, because of the implications of that. So I will invariably say to families in these kind of situations where drugs are involved as well, let's see what happens, A, when we separate them from the drug, and B, over the next year, because these kind of big diagnoses, they sometimes stare you in the face, but even when they do, you usually hedge your bets a bit until you're really sure, because of the implications, both for treatment and for the prognosis.
Willie Gilmour.
In his Gospel commentaries, Henriksen distinguishes between demon possession that took place particularly in Jesus' ministry and demon influence today. Can you think that's a valid distinction? And how do you look at this demonic side of things? Does it come into your categories at all?
It does. I think it's very difficult, and I'll give you some general thoughts. I'm not sure about the possession and influence thing. I mean, there may be something in that. The demon possession question comes up again and again and again. And John White, who's written at some length about this, divides us Christians into three camps. People who see demons under every bed, people who don't see them at all, and the majority of us who sit on the fence. And I confess to having been a fence sitter, though there have been certainly two or three, you know, a few times in my career where I have asked myself that question. Could this be some kind of demonic influence? I'll not for the minute argue about the terminology of whether it's possession or influence. And one or two folk have written quite helpfully in this. Andrew Sims is one. Donald MacLeod published an article 10 years ago in the Free Church Record. And it was interesting coming, writing unbeknownst to each other, and coming from different slants. They were saying some similar things. And one of the things that they were both saying is that the more a person talks about being possessed by demons, the less likely it is that they are. And lots of my, well, not lots, but it's not that uncommon for my patients to talk about that. So that's one thing that both the clergyman and the psychiatrist agreed on. The other useful thing they pointed to was looking beyond the phenomena you're presented with to the patient's general behaviour and social integration, and asking yourself the question, is, you know, is this compatible with what we know to be true about mental disorder? And if not, could it be this other thing? I think Michael Green and I Believe in Satan's Downfall has written quite extensively and usefully on this, and I wish I could remember all he's said, but these are two bits of guidance that people have given that I've found helpful. One thing I have done on a couple of occasions, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this, is with one person in particular who I was concerned about in this area, I started talking to him in the course of a clinical concentration about Christian things to see what kind of a reaction I got, and I got a non-reaction. I think some people would maybe have counseled me that that wasn't a wise thing to do, but I decided on this occasion to do it. I suppose reasoning with myself that had he been demon-possessed, I might have got a more vigorous response.
What actual evidence would you give for saying that Elijah, David, Job, and Paul, that their experience shows that being a believer is not necessarily contrary to immunity from mental illness? You know, what sort of specifically in
your mind? I wasn't. No, you've misunderstood me. I wasn't suggesting that they had mental illness at all. I was suggesting that they all had crosses to bear and dark times in their lives and at times probably psychological difficulties. You could maybe, stretching it, make the case that Elijah had a depressive episode. But if you thought I was saying that, you have misunderstood me. What I was saying is that I don't believe, incidentally, it doesn't refute my belief that I don't think Christians are protected from mental illness. But I wasn't saying that these gentlemen had all experienced mental illness.